I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. It's summertime. If you're lucky, maybe you get to spend some time at the beach this year. Swimming in the sun is definitely in our minds, so we thought it would be a fun idea to use this episode to show appreciation for the ocean.
That's right. This week, we're speaking with Max Bellow, an international ocean policy expert who works with the organization Mission Blue to establish marine protected areas around the world. We ask Max to give us a status update on the health of the world's oceans and to give us details on what we can do to protect Earth's most life-giving biome.
Here's Max.
Hi, my name is Max Bellow. I'm Chilean, but I'm based in the US and I work on marine conservation. I love working on creating new marine protected areas or helping governments to create new marine protected areas. And I have the beauty of working with one of my heroes, Sylvia Earle, which is an amazing thing to do.
Who is Sylvia Earle?
She's an inspiration, biggest inspiration for me and I guess many people, and I hope many more people will be inspired with her life. She's a biologist by training. She's an oceanographer. She was the first woman in charge of science at NOAA too. But also she's been, you know, rewarded and recognized by different institutions. She holds like, I don't know how many titles, like PhD and post PhDs and everything. So she's an incredible scientist, but also she's a great communicator. She most of the things that we hear, like, you know, without blue, there's no green, or any of those things are actually Sylvia Earle quotes. And she does this amazing communication thing that she kind of like brings the ocean into whatever she talks. So it's, I mean, an amazing person to work with. She is 85 years old right now and still diving. I was diving with her the last time we were actually, she was diving. We were in Seychelles and also we were in Galapagos, and she's like nonstop, incredible.
Yeah, I think when you're trying to protect the ocean, it must give you life, like the fountain of youth, right? It gives you life to protect life.
I totally think she does that. I mean, I always say, like, when after she comes out of the water, she kind of rejuvenates. I mean, it's amazing.
Stephanie's like that too. Stephanie's exactly
the same. It is true. There is something in there which is magic.
Can you summarize the state of our oceans and why the oceans are so important to addressing global warming and climate change?
Well, look, I need to say that there are many sources of threat. One of the biggest, though, it's actually the lack of action to protect the ocean. But we know now, and this is something that Sylvia normally says, we know the state of the ocean. We have enough information right now. We always welcome more information, more science, but the information is telling us the ocean are not that big piece of Earth that we could, you know, keep taking from and keep, you know, trashing or throwing, you know, all our rubbish. And one of the key elements that the scientists have said, the main threat is actually the loss of biodiversity, which is directly connected with the overfishing. So that's the main threat to the ocean. Then you have the climate change, which keeps growing. The ocean has been absorbing more than 90% of the excess of temperature in the atmosphere. And that is warming up the ocean. An ocean and a water with higher temperature means less oxygen. And life in the water, as we do, lives with oxygen. They need fish and other species. They need the oxygen from the ocean, from the water. So that means that then there's less capacity for that those species to live. They're moving away, but we don't know for how long. That also, the ocean as itself, it's the most important sequestration body on Earth, more important than all the combined forests in the world. But that also have another price to pay for the ocean, which is the acidification. The more sequestering to, then the more CO2 that is in the water, the lower the the acidification. I mean, the higher the acidification, that means then the many species like crustaceans and others, you know, cannot build up their skeleton or whatever you call it. That is basically the structure of their bodies. Then you have also the coastal areas are suffering because of also the increase on the level of the sea, which have to do with the warming itself, the volume of the water, but also with the melting of the glaciers. We know some of the areas has been more affected is the Antarctica, which is the heart, also the blue heart for the oceans of the world. So it's all connected. And then you have pollution. Then you have also the plastic crisis and many of the things that we don't see. The plastic is the easy one to see. What about all the other chemicals we've been throwing? Fertilizers, herbicides, I mean, all of that that for years have been affecting. So always when I have to explain what are the threats, it's really the combinations of all of them together. We can't treat them all apart. The ocean is getting pressure from all of this and more.
Is there one common root cause? You would say you would single out one, really one common cause, which is kind of the cause of all of these multiple diverse problems?
Humans. That's the answer to that. That's the common ground for this, sadly.
Well, humans and our behavior.
Correct. I think it's our behavior. And as I said, the lack of action once we have the information. I said also sometimes it's ignorance still, you know, for those people who doesn't take in account this information that is now available. I mean, you know, we live in an incredible time where information is out there everywhere. We know now what are the actions that we need to take. And that is something that Sylvia keeps repeating. We know we have the information. Now, how we use it. Seeing, for example, the overexposition of a species that continues, you know, I mean, look at the FAO says, you know, 30% of the stocks, fish stock are already overexploited, but then 60% are on fully exploitation. That for most of the scientists, biologists, it's actually they're already overexploited. So we're talking about 90% of the stocks of the planet already overexploited. What are we waiting for taking action to actually stop that situation? No?
Yeah, what are we waiting for?
I think it's more engagement of people. People need to understand. Everyone has been touched by the ocean. No? I mean, the ocean have produced historically at least 50% of the oxygen on Earth. So, you know, one on two breath actually belongs or comes from the ocean. So even if you're living in the mountains far from the ocean, if you haven't even seen the ocean ever, you still, your life is connected. And so humanity and life on Earth, it is connected. NASA has been looking for a liquid ocean. You know, that's what they're looking when they're looking for life on in the space. So now knowing those things, I think it is the everyone's kind of work to actually take care of the ocean, not just those that are using and extracting it. That normally is the case. No, I have campaigns where, you know, the government says, well, you need to talk with the fishermen. Well, as a government, you should be providing for everyone. You should be aware of everyone in your country. And everyone actually should be part of a decision of protecting it or not. Not just those who are making money out of taking fish.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there you actually hit the button, which is making money. And that's the incentive for all of us as humans to do whatever we do. What are the incentives that are available to people to do take the action that you want us to take?
If you care about your own existence, your family, your kids, yourself, your, you know, anyone that you love, then you should care about the ocean. I mean, if that doesn't work, then what? Most of the fish that is being produced, the money that is being made out of actually extracting, it's basically for luxury. I mean, who consumed that fish? Like, let's look at the tuna fishery that has been driven, you know, overfishing on most of the tuna species around the world. It's a highly subsidized industry, you know, by wealthy, rich countries that basically is, you know, taking all this tuna from around the world in the Pacific, everywhere, the whole Pacific, the whole Atlantic, the whole Indian Ocean. There's some of the same companies there, some of the same countries that they belongs to. And so to your question again, I mean, this is not a need of protein, as many people said, is not a need of, you know, feeding people that needs fish. There is that part too, but they will not have a fish if we don't stop that kind of use of the ocean.
Yeah, my question for, you know, kind of what are we waiting for is kind of pointing to what I've heard from in the webinar I attended with Mission Blue, where Sylvia kind of pointed to the consciousness shift and the different generations. Well, she made it very clear that we have to have a consciousness shift because obviously, you know, we have the data, we have the technology, we could basically stop it like this, right? But we don't. So what are we waiting for is, I guess, the consciousness shift. We as humans have not yet realized that somehow everything we do, wherever we live, even though most cities are near the ocean, but even if you're inland, are actually connected to the ocean. And so what is this consciousness shift? Do you think this is pointing to the right direction? Or
I think it is. I mean, I think you're right on. I tend to see a lot more involvement of younger generations. I have been called, I can't even tell you how many people, young people are calling me through Instagram, to Twitter, phone, they get my phone or my email, you know. And they're mainly, I would say 90% of them, they're very young people, students, whether they're in school or in college. And I think that demonstrates a little bit of this, you know, urgency too. I think they're scared. I tend to also, you know, remember what happened with my generation when we were talking about the nuclear, you know, threat. And I would, you know, have dreams and I felt disempowered. I mean, I didn't have, you know, what do I do? You know, with, like, and so I think the kids with the technology, with the things that we have now today, with the social network and everything, they have some sort of tool to actually at least express that. And I think Greta, of course, is one of the best examples of that. Whether that is considered like a change, I don't know. I mean, on the conscience, I mean, I think it's to be seen. Now, what I definitely see is, there is a change, whether in this group, but also that I work, for example, a lot with politicians. You see the interest of doing something. And I keep questioning myself, what is that? Because I also wanted to understand better so I can use it better too. But you know, in Latin America, there have been some sort of this healthy competition of who does bigger marine protected areas. And that is connected with some of the shifting on the power too, that is caring more about that, you know. I mean, the fact that, for example, Wall Street was publishing 2 days ago about the, you know, the situation with the Great Barrier Reef in Australia and the possibility that UNESCO is going to, you know, put it on the list, endangered list. I mean, I don't remember much of when Wall Street was actually publishing things, specific things like that about environment, about the coral reef, about UNESCO heritage being, you know, listing an area. I mean, it really is impressive. You know, I was just a few days ago with the president of Panama, and he was so eager to do more, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Like, they are already sending letters to the other countries in the vicinity, you know, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and Colombia, to do more for protecting. That is definitely ship that I've seen.
Your strategy for the most part is to protect large areas of ocean from fishing at all, basically, or, you know, severely limit the fishing in those areas so that the marine life and the biological resources can regenerate, correct?
Correct.
And you had accomplished that through political action, through legislation. So I wonder if you could kind of speak to the kind of connection between politics as a pathway to activism and how that works so people can have access to taking action, and then also other kinds of action that people can take to address this horrible condition of our oceans.
Correct. I mean, yeah, you're right. I do many things. You know, I work a lot in the UN bodies, you know, been working for many years. But one of the things that I like the most, and not that it's the only answer also, because there's no silver bullet for this, but which is something that we are still far behind, and it's very clear it does good for the ocean and for everyone, is the marine protected areas. And I think there is a need of shifting the understanding. You know, many governments before and people thought, you know, like, well, this is like putting aside, like taking, like kind of closing an area. It means that we are kind of, I don't know, it's like cutting part of your body, and, you know, and it's not. It's actually one of the best investment in many ways. I mean, it's the best investment, first of all, for life, you know. It actually works so well with resilience of this place. And we were talking about the threats, no? If you eliminate many of the threats, if you're able to eliminate or mitigate at least many of the biggest threats over the ocean, then of course you're going to have a more resilient ocean. What do I mean? For example, we collectively need to solve the climate change issue, no? But we can solve, for example, overexploitation of resources, of, you know, particularly economic exclusive zone where the fishermen are going, etc. The pollution that gets there, you know, for example, we're talking about the Great Barrier Reef. One of the biggest problems they had for years is the herbicide and fertilizer that comes from the cane production, you know, in that area. You could change those things. If you can take those, you eliminate many of the pressures. It's when, like, you get sick, no? I mean, if you start feeling sick, of course, you take care of yourself. And that is exactly what the ocean, we need to provide the ocean some sort of rest from those things. Highly and fully marine protected areas, which are, you know, the golden standard, are the golden standard because we know now they can produce 7 times more biomass than other marine protected areas that still have extraction. That itself proves you that those places can be not only good for the ocean itself, but for economy, for anything else, you know, and life in particular of humanity.
Max, could we actually recover? Like, could the oceans at this point, now it's summer 2021, could we actually recover? Or is it everything we do at this point only kind of damage control in terms of insurance language?
It's a big discussion, you know. I mean, when you look at the coral reefs, we know now that we've lost more than 50% of them, you know. The fact that we can bring maybe back some, or, like, you know, have some coral doesn't mean that you can build coral reef necessarily. And then we need to realize that, you know, humans, we're very intelligent. But we haven't been able to create a coral reef. That's evolution, that's nature itself. So I think no matter what the situation it is, we need to act as soon as possible because it's urgent. I tend to think that we're very much, you know, borderline. You know, I want to keep my hopes, but all the information that keep coming, all that I've seen personally, it's extremely worrisome. I mean, like, I think we're in a very dramatic stage. the ocean is big, it's huge. There's so much diversity. There's more diversity than everywhere in land, down deep in the ocean. No? And I think we still don't know the effects of those things and how actually the ocean will, you know, will react to those things too. But we now know that all of these pressures are real, are having a huge effect on the ocean, and we're losing big part of the diversity that is the web of life. So I would say we need to act as actually we are in urgency on a real crisis. And I don't know if that answered your question.
Well, I've heard that 10% of big fish are left, which is really not a lot. And when you point to overfishing, that means it's, you know, it's going to be gone in a couple of years. So there is basically, you know, once it's gone, it's gone. Like, as you say, the same with coral reefs, right? We can't just recreate it if we wanted to. And we recently had this webinar about universal basic income, and I had a guy from Namibia who pointed out that they threw, I don't know if you know this experiment about your universal basic income, it's basically your basic needs are met, right? And he gave an example of in Namibia how the, what was it? The
poachers.
Basically stopped, 95% all of a sudden stopped because people, you know, they don't hunt because of getting the profit, but they hunt because they need to meet their basic needs. Is there some sort of similar situation with overfishing? You said the tuna you gave the example where it's basically the rich countries, right, with overfishing, but the rest of it, what is it that we don't stop overfishing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a great paper, no, the strategy of the commons, which talk exactly about that. In the ocean, it's even more interesting what happened always because, I mean, what other activity you have where by killing something then becomes have a price? No? I mean, the fish don't have a price when it's alive and free down there. You kill it, you take it out, and it has a price, you know. Even on hunting and other things, you know, you still have to consider some other cost. The cost and the investment at the same time of, you know, investing in conservation of the ocean has never been considered. If you look at the last report of the organizations of developed countries, it says that less than 1% of the budget of the developed countries is going to marine conservation. I mean, but then you look at how much, for example, the EU is investing on subsidies, agriculture and fisheries, over 50% of their budget, it's for subsidies. Now that creates inequality for many, no? I mean, I've seen it in my own country, how, you know, Spaniard companies were going there, buying the rights, at least 50% or whatever the law allows them, and they're overfishing, you know, the hake. There was one company, at a certain point, from Spain, that owns 99 of the hake quotas around the world. So, and these people managed to actually overfish all of them. So there's no accountability also for that kind of fish, you know? And so you have all this investment, incredible investments to maintain these fisheries, to maintain that sort of, you know, business and that culture, but that only allows you to keep fishing, keep fishing, keep fishing.
Yeah.
You finish one, you go to the next.
Which leads us back to the question of politics and what's the process for you of enacting a law that actually protects them? How do you get protections in place? And how do our listeners help you do that?
Well, you know, and I think it's a lot of experience on how to do the most to protect. So for example, in Chile, we have 43% of protection, which 40% is highly unfully. You know, that's the best. And it's easier to control, to enforce, because if there's a vessel inside, you know, what are you doing there? That's closed. You should not be there. You know, if you're doing, if a fishing, you know, vessel is there, it's like, well, you're doing something wrong, most likely. So it helps actually to enforce. It helps big pieces of the ocean that need to, you know, because species in the ocean needs much bigger range and areas. So convincing, you know, politicians to do the right thing, they need to be also with great information of what we know now about marine protected areas. But marine protected areas have been here for over 1,000 years. I mean, look at just the Polynesians. They've created Rahui, Tapu, and other things you need to protect the ocean. They knew it worked. We know now it works. There's a lot of papers out there. And so showing that, you know, and also getting this interest on, like, the ocean is now part of this global diplomacy and all of that combined, then it make them take the right decision. But you need to kind of help them also to understand this is exactly how it needs to be done. And then you have also protected not just the biology, not just the life, but also the things that are not alive there, which are rocks, which is the underground of those areas, which is also very key, because there is a huge now motivation for going exploiting now the deep sea sort of like minerals and others. So all of these things need to be combined. And in order to do that, you need to provide with the right information why that is needed.
Do you feel that in the political process, there's lobbyists that you that are making as much inroads to open up the fisheries, open up the opportunities for deep sea mining, and you're at a battle with them? And what are the factors that shift the scales of that battle?
Absolutely. I mean, I tell you, I find them all everywhere, whether they're the global ones or where they're the local ones, no? Let's look at, you know, for example, Ecuador. We've been trying to, you know, to help the government to expand the Galapagos marine protected area. It's been basically pushed back by the industry of tuna in Ecuador, which is, if not the biggest, one of the biggest tuna fleet on earth now. And they have incredible relations with the government, no matter what the government comes in or out. The same, you know, with my experience, for example, in Chile, in Patagonia, when we try, you know, years ago to create a several marine protected areas in Patagonia, was pushed back by the industry, salmon farming. And they were embedded in the government. They had created a legislation that fits them perfectly. To the point that, for example, I mean, 50% almost of these companies are Norwegian, and they behave completely different in Norway because they knew what they needed and what they wanted from Chile. And so, you know, they work with their lobbyists to create exactly the bill that will let them do what they can do in Norway and produce then cheaper, produce a bigger amount in terms of volume, less quality and other things. No, so that is definitely, I mean, they have years of experience. We're just getting, you know, there. But I think one of the biggest powers we have, it's actually the power of the public transparency, the power of people getting involved. No, and for Chileans, for example, if you look at you know, statistics and polls they have set for the last few years, one of the key elements for them, it is nature conservation. So you see, for example, we just had a election, I mean, elections for electing people that will work on a new constitution in Chile. And that new constitution, one of the main key elements of why the people vote for this representatives, it's nature conservation. So you see that is, and what we need to keep pushing is that exactly knowledge. I mean, like, for people to get involved on those things.
Yeah, I always wonder, you know, there are always people behind, you know, even in these laws, there's always some decision maker, there's always, you know, people who are like craft, who need to write a proposal up, no? And I wonder what time it will be that there is like, oh, I'm not writing this up, this is completely against our planet. You understand what I mean? It's like, I wonder when this moment in time will come that more people are like, oh, this is not good. I know this is on my paycheck. I will be paid. I am part of this company, but I'm not doing this. You do it. And then maybe the next time I say, I'm not doing this neither. This is crap. You know? I don't know.
I don't think that's ever going to happen until the economic system changes. I mean, it's all about economic incentives in the end.
I think they're both together. We can't leave it only to the decision of you know, money, and even money can be changed by that. No, for example, you know, I lately sort of, you know, decided to put some of my IRS sort of 401k here in the US to work for my kids, no, on investment. And so then I work with the bank to actually, what are the companies where you're going to put? I don't want to put in anything, just like, you know, take my money and make it more oil, or, you know, no, I don't want it. So I started observing that, and actually the list of companies, they were like horrible. Some of them actually, you know, were making horrible things in Chile, in Latin America, etc. So I started kind of looking into, and I'm now more engaged in where that money goes. And so talking with other, you know, investment sort of companies to say, like, you need to look where this money, if you look at the, you know, the bulk of in the US, like the exactly that retirement sort of funding, it is a massive amount that is being used to destroy the nature. If we are more aware of what we do, I think it could be impressive. But that also requires, as you said, you both said, you know, like for us to have this conscience and to understand this, that's bad. What these people are doing is bad. And to know exactly you want to change that. I think both things are coming together, I see, little by little, but they're coming together somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are, and I agree with you, and I think we are becoming collectively more conscious. But at the same time, the threat of your ocean dying versus not being able to feed your child or pay your rent the next month is, you are always going to take care of the immediate problem. And so there's always a trickle down of exploiting the lesser wealthy countries, the lesser wealthy people, because they're desperate to survive, and that imperative is operating all the time until we all agree we're going to stop doing this and we're going to actually pay you to help us protect the ocean. You know, like that's really, you have to be able to equate, and this is why we're very interested in these root economic problems. Because of this problem of immediacy, we know that oceans are going to die in 6 years, but that's still irrelevant relative to my kid potentially not eating tonight. So I have to figure out, we need to figure out a way for to provide incentives that come all the way down to the right now for all of us.
Most of the fishing occurs, I mean, it is a choice. The fact that you eat fish is a choice. And most of us have the capacity to actually move into something different. And I think that the conspiracy movie actually does a good job on kind of calling on that. And so if we change, we are able to change it. For example, just on the discussion of the WTO subsidies discussion, which is extremely important, and it's coming now soon actually to potentially have some effect. If you only focus on the industry, you could have almost like a 30%, around 30% of biomass increasing by taking those subsidies, negative subsidies on the industry. That's the power. But that also tells you how much impact that industry, and that is wealthy people, big companies. We're not talking about here people that need to feed their kids tomorrow. Actually, if you take that and you look at, you know, Senegal and many other countries in West Africa or in Latin America, where those companies, highly subsidized, are taking the fish by contract with those countries, et cetera, et cetera, you will have more fish for those people who actually live day by day. So, you know, I think that may be something that some people have been talking about, conspiracy doesn't cover. But the public that it was directed is for people like us that have the choice, and that choice will affect, in the end, the future of all the people that have no choice.
So, Max, just a personal question. Are you eating fish?
No, I don't eat fish.
So you've radically erased fish from your menu?
I erased fish. No. I haven't erased meat, though, which is equally impacting, probably. I'm from Chile, from the south of Chile, where my parents, you know, we have a culture of showing love also through, you know, making a barbecue, etc. They have that part still they need to work on. I've been for years also vegetarian, then I went back, then, you know, back to meat, back to, but what I totally erased from my menus is fish and sea life. I definitely need to work on the meat.
Yeah. I mean, I love fish, I have to admit, right? So I go to this local fishmonger here on the Green Market, and I realized the other day, and I actually asked the guy for the first time, because he's got the sign up, like local fishing, like, you know, what's it called? Long Island fishing. And I asked him, so where do you actually fish? And he explained to me, like, the little fleet they have, and da, da, da. And then I realized, basically, you can I believe him, sort of, but basically, he can tell me anything he likes, right? I have no way of controlling that this fish I'm buying there, or the clams, or, you know, whatever I bought that day, is actually coming from this little family-run business, and they don't do overfishing. They don't, you know, all this list. Where I say, yeah, cool. You know, do they really? I have no idea of controlling it. Right?
Yeah, the you know, it's interesting. There are a few places where you could have that sort of control. I work a lot on a big marine project there in Rapa Nui, Easter Island, and that's one of the few places where I would eat fish with the people, because part of the culture, you know, it's a respectful thing to do, and they fish. I mean, it's as fresh as you could see, and they fish one tuna, take it back to the boat. Take it back to the town, you know, selling it, you know, or part of for the family, part of for selling to the restaurant, etc. And then they go, you know, 1 week out of business because they want to stay with the family. And so that's a place where I always, you know, I feel safe. But to your question, too, I mean, like, for example, I don't drink Coca-Cola years, like 20 years, none of this soft sort of, you know, drinks. And I'm not saying it's not good. Sugar rich and everything is delicious, but is it good for us, for environment, for, you know, for the humanity, with all the production of plastic and all of that, you know? So, you know, I think that's what basically, you know, we need to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's do it. Coca-Cola is not good. Let's just say it. And all, including all the others, the other sugar waters with different flavors. Anyways, is there anything, Max, we haven't asked you would really like to say?
Look, I think I really appreciate, and I really like, you know, I spend a lot of my time trying to communicate, because I think it is important to everyone gets, you know, involved. I normally say, you know, even though we talk about Sylvia Earle as a hero, and she's truly a hero, I think it is important to remember there's no Superman. There's no Wonder Woman in here. We can't wait for someone to come and save us. This is a common thing. If we have to do this, we have to do it all together. And everyone have to feel a hero. And I think it is great that you guys are, you know, doing this, because more people need to hear it. More people need to understand the state of the ocean and how important it is for humanity, for you, for your family, for everyone. And so I just thank you for that, and thank you for being a part of this collective heroes too, which I hope I am too.
Absolutely, you are.
Thank you, Max.
When I think about the condition of the oceans and how huge the oceans are, I just feel completely overwhelmed. You know, like, how are we gonna I guess it's the same as climate change. How are we going to solve this problem? You feel powerless as an individual in some ways.
Yeah, and as I said, like recently, you know, after, you know, we've become aware of this ocean problem years ago, you know, really years ago, and then comes to the moment where you have a choice between not buying fish and buying fish. And so there was our decision to go to the green market, to go to a local fishmonger. And again, you stand in front of the fish, you see the people who sell the fish, and it's a family-run business. And you know that it kind of depends on what you buy this day. And then this inquiry, where does the fish actually come from, right? And there, I realized there's zero control, zero transparency, of where this fish, where are the clams, where are the mussels, where do they actually come from? And can I be sure that is my choice of, you know, eating fish, which is already in a way unsustainable, okay? And I guess it will never be okay.
The only way to be sure is to just stop eating fish. And I think that's the extreme situation that we're in. We just stop eating fish if you want to be sure you're not exploiting the oceans. Until we can recover and protect our ocean wildlife, our ocean nature.
Yeah, and you call it extreme, but it's actually in comparison to the state of the oceans, this is not extreme. What is extreme is that we only have 10% of big fish left. That, you know, our oceans are in a catastrophic state. And Max made this wonderful job of listing all these kind. It's not just overfishing, and it's not just pollution. It's like all these different problems at the same time. And there is no way that a single woman or a single man or a single organization can tackle that problem.
Yep,
and so we are facing we are in this extreme situation. So the choice of maybe not eating fish, the choice of not maybe not eating meat, or become very conscious about what you eat, and also how you eat it, by the way, is not extreme, I would say.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I feel like we're like the frog in the water, right? The frog in the pot that slowly heats up until pretty soon the frog is in the pot boiling and never jumps out. And here we are in the pot almost boiling, and it's time for us to jump out, yet the urgency, the immediacy of that problem is not really present for most of us, or we would be jumping out of that pot, and we're not. And I think he gives us a couple of actions, like one, stop eating fish, two, get conscious and use your voice to shift the political process so that we can get these subsidies reversed, we can protect these oceans, and start to allow nature to recover. But gosh, it's so hard to see the immediacy of that problem in your everyday life.
Yeah, I think we talked about it the other day, because there's this willingness to ignore.
Willful ignorance, that's what I call it. Willful ignorance.
As long as it's to our own little daily profit, or to the well-being of our family, or that we can feed somewhere, you know, whatever. And there's this willingness to ignore the bigger picture.
Yeah. But we all have it, you know. We have to very consciously overcome our willful ignorance. Right?
I couldn't agree more. We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.